A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been digging into the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitats database at skyscrapercenter.com, and he noticed something that's been quietly reshaping how we think about tall buildings. A 20-story building and a 120-story building both get called skyscrapers, but they share about as much structurally as a rowboat shares with an aircraft carrier. The question is, where do the real thresholds fall? What actually changes at each one, and why can't you just scale up?
The timing is perfect, because the CTBUH's mid-year data just dropped. 18 megatalls completed or topped out globally. That's buildings over 600 meters, with 7 more under construction. The stratification isn't theoretical anymore. It's hardening into real, distinct tiers with their own engineering rulebooks.
What exactly counts as a skyscraper to begin with, and who gets to decide?
That's the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. They're the global authority. They maintain the database, they set the official height criteria, and their website, skyscrapercenter.com, is the definitive public face of all this. Their baseline definition, a skyscraper, is 50 meters or taller. That's roughly 12 plus stories for an office building, maybe 14 or 15 for residential, depending on floor-to-floor height. Below that, and this is important, you're in high-rise territory, which is a separate category entirely. A lot of buildings people casually call skyscrapers don't actually meet the CTBUH threshold.
My apartment building is not a skyscraper. Good to know. I was feeling very cosmopolitan.
Unless you're living in a 50-meter tower, no. And from that 50-meter floor, the CTBUH defines two more official tiers. A super tall is anything over 300 meters. A megatall is over 600 meters. Those numbers aren't arbitrary. They're where the physics shifts.
That's the episode. What actually changes when you cross each of those lines? Not just more floors, not just a bigger elevator bank, but the entire engineering paradigm.
Let's start with the tier most people actually encounter, the ordinary skyscraper, 50 to 300 meters. These are the workhorses of any skyline, and their dominant challenge isn't gravity, it's wind.
The thing that makes your coffee ripple on the 45th floor.
Around 100 meters, buildings start needing serious lateral systems to keep accelerations below about 25 mg. That's the threshold where occupants start feeling motion sickness. Below that, people don't notice. Above it, you get complaints, and in some cases, you get buildings that are technically safe but functionally unoccupiable on windy days.
25 mg? That's a tiny fraction of gravity. We're that sensitive?
It's not about structural failure, it's about human comfort. The building could be perfectly safe while making everyone inside queasy. Think of it like seasickness. A ship in heavy seas isn't necessarily in danger of sinking, but that doesn't stop your inner ear from rebelling. Same principle, except you're on land, in an office, trying to have a meeting while your body is quietly convinced you're on a very slow roller coaster. So engineers deploy tuned mass dampers or outrigger systems. A tuned mass damper is basically a giant pendulum, a huge weight, sometimes hundreds of tons, suspended near the top of the building. When wind pushes the building one way, the damper swings the other way, canceling the motion. Taipei 101 has a famous one. A 660-ton golden sphere you can actually visit as a tourist.
A 600-ton gold ball hanging in the sky to stop you from spilling your coffee. Civil engineering is just applied absurdity.
But here's the thing about tuned mass dampers. They're single-purpose devices. They're tuned to one specific frequency, the building's primary sway mode. If an earthquake hits, which has a completely different frequency profile, that 600-ton gold ball is just dead weight. In some scenarios, it can actually make things worse if it starts swinging at the wrong moment. So buildings in seismic zones often skip the damper entirely and go with the other approach. Outrigger systems, horizontal trusses that connect the central concrete core to the perimeter columns. Imagine you're trying to bend a ruler. If you just hold one end, it flexes easily. But if you brace it at multiple points along its length with your other hand, suddenly it's much stiffer. That's what outriggers do. They tie the core to the outer columns at intervals up the building, forcing the whole structure to act as one unit against the wind. Most buildings in the 50 to 300 meter range use some combination of a concrete core, a steel frame, and either dampers or outriggers. The elevator systems at this tier are still relatively straightforward, single-deck cabs grouped into zones serving 10 to 15 floors each. You switch elevators at a sky lobby if the building's tall enough, but the machinery is standard. You can buy it from a catalog.
That's the rank-and-file skyscraper. What happens when you push past 300 meters into super-tall territory?
Three things change simultaneously, and they all interact. First, wind loads become the primary lateral design driver even in seismic regions. At 200 meters, in an earthquake zone like Tokyo or San Francisco, seismic forces might still govern your structural design. At 300 meters, wind takes over almost everywhere. The building is now a sail.
Because wind forces scale with height non-linearly?
Roughly with the square of wind speed and the projected area. But the real issue isn't just the force, it's the dynamic behavior. Tall buildings are flexible. They have natural frequencies. Wind isn't steady. It gusts, it forms vortices, it creates fluctuating pressures. If those fluctuations match the building's natural frequency, you get resonance. The building starts swaying more and more, feeding on the wind's energy. That's the nightmare scenario.
You're tuning the building like a musical instrument, trying to make sure it doesn't hum at the wind's frequency.
That's actually exactly right. Structural engineers talk about detuning a building. They adjust the mass and stiffness so the natural frequency sits outside the range of expected wind excitation. And here's a concrete example of what happens when you get it wrong. The Citigroup Center in New York, completed in 1977, 59 stories, well within the ordinary skyscraper range. A year after completion, an engineering student pointed out that the building's bolted joints were vulnerable to quartering winds, winds hitting the building at a 45-degree angle. The original design had assumed perpendicular winds were the worst case. They weren't. The building was at risk of collapse in a hurricane. The firm spent months secretly welding reinforcement plates at night while the building was occupied. The public didn't find out until nearly 20 years later.
Secret nighttime structural retrofits on an occupied skyscraper. That's genuinely terrifying.
That was a 59-story building with a conventional structural system. The wind behavior at 300 meters is orders of magnitude more complex. Shanghai Tower, which is 632 meters, well into megatall territory, has a 1,000-ton tuned mass damper. 1,000 tons. That's not a pendulum anymore. That's a suspended building inside a building. The damper alone weighs more than most small apartment blocks.
The second thing that changes at 300 meters?
Single-deck cabs serving 15-floor zones stop making sense. The shafts would take up too much of the floor plate. So you switch to double-deck elevators, one cab stacked on top of the other, serving two floors at once, or you go to a sky lobby transfer system. Passengers ride an express elevator to a sky lobby at, say, the 40th floor, then switch to a local elevator for the final leg. It's like a vertical transit system with express and local lines.
The building becomes a subway map, turned on its side.
And that introduces a whole new operational headache. What happens when an express elevator breaks down? In a 30-story building, if an elevator fails, people take the stairs or wait for another cab. In a supertall with sky lobby transfers, a failed express elevator can strand hundreds of people dozens of floors from the ground. You need redundant express shafts, which eats up even more core space, which makes the economics worse. It's a cascade of problems that all trace back to that single decision to go taller.
The third change?
Pumping concrete 300 meters straight up is a serious logistical challenge. You need specialized high-pressure pumps, and the mix design has to be carefully engineered so the aggregate doesn't separate from the cement paste under pressure. If it separates, you get blockages in the line, and clearing a blocked pump line 300 meters up is not a phone call anyone wants to make.
I imagine the conversation starts with, "You're going to want to sit down," and ends with a very large invoice.
Burj Khalifa set the record for vertical concrete pumping at 606 meters. They used a specially designed high-pressure pump and a mix with precisely graded aggregate. That record stood for years. And here's a fun fact that illustrates how extreme this gets. At those pressures, the concrete mix has to be designed so it doesn't set too fast. Because if it starts curing inside the pipe, you've just created a 600 meter long concrete plug. They use retardant admixtures to delay the set time, then the concrete cures rapidly once it's placed. It's chemistry and logistics on a knife edge.
Alright, so at 300 meters, you've got wind dominance, elevator system redesign, and concrete logistics. What happens at 600 meters, the megatall threshold?
This is where everything compounds into unprecedented problems. Problem 1. Vortex shedding. Wind flowing past a building creates alternating vortices on either side, like the eddies behind a rock in a stream. These vortices detach at regular intervals, creating a fluctuating pressure that pushes the building side to side. If the vortex shedding frequency matches the building's natural frequency, you get what's called lock-in, sustained, dangerous oscillation.
You can't just make the building stiffer to avoid it.
You can, but stiffness costs money and floor area. The smarter approach is aerodynamic shaping. Burj Khalifa doesn't fight the vortices, it breaks them up. Its stepped, buttressed core means the building's profile changes at different heights. Vortices that form at one level get disrupted by the setback above. The wind never gets a clean, uninterrupted run along the full height. It's aerodynamic architecture. The shape is the solution. Think of it like the dimples on a golf ball. Those dimples aren't decorative. They trip the airflow into turbulence, which reduces the size of the wake behind the ball and cuts drag. Burj Khalifa's setbacks do the same thing at a 1,000-foot scale.
The Burj is 828 meters. What's the elevator situation at that height?
This is problem 2. Steel elevator cables become too heavy to support themselves above roughly 500 meters. The rope's own weight exceeds its tensile capacity. You can just make it thicker because the added thickness adds more weight. It's a losing game. Burj Khalifa uses Kevlar reinforced cables, which are lighter and stronger than steel. And even then, no single elevator runs the full height. The building has 57 elevators and 8 escalators, organized into multiple sky lobby transfer zones. It's the world's tallest transit system.
57 elevators. A typical 50-story building has maybe 6 to 8. The core must be enormous.
That's the third problem, and it's an economic one. Above about 80 floors, the core, elevators, stairs, mechanical shafts, structural walls, eats up so much floor area that leasable space drops to around 60 to 65% of gross floor area. In a 30-story building, you might lease 75 to 80%. In a megatall, you're building a lot of structure that nobody pays rent on.
You're spending more to build less usable space. The economics are running in reverse.
There's a fourth problem most people don't think about: thermal expansion. The sunny side of a megatall can be 10 to 15 degrees Celsius warmer than the shaded side. Steel and concrete expand when heated. That differential movement, the sunny side literally growing taller than the shaded side, has to be accommodated in every cladding panel, every structural connection, every window gasket. If you don't design for it, you get buckled panels, cracked glass, and leaking seals.
A building that breathes. That's unnerving.
It's not a small effect. On a 1,000-meter tower, a 15-degree temperature difference across the building can produce several centimeters of differential expansion. That might not sound like much, but glass and aluminum cladding systems are designed with tolerances measured in millimeters. If your curtain wall can't accommodate that movement, something's going to crack. And at 800 meters up, replacing a cracked panel requires a crane and a very calm day.
Now consider the Jeddah Tower, which is under construction and planned to reach 1,000 meters, a full kilometer into the sky. It'll need active damping systems that haven't been deployed at this scale before. Not passive dampers like a pendulum, active systems with sensors, actuators, and control algorithms that push back against the wind in real time. And its elevator cables will be bespoke engineering projects, not off-the-shelf products. Every component at that height becomes a research project. You can't just take a super tall design and add floors. The problems aren't additive, they're multiplicative.
That's the core insight. Each threshold introduces qualitatively new physics. Below 300 meters, you're managing comfort. Between 300 and 600, you're managing dynamic wind behavior and vertical transportation logistics. Above 600, you're managing aerodynamics, material limits, thermal dynamics, and construction processes that have never been attempted before.
All of that feeds into the economics. What does the cost curve actually look like?
It's aggressively non-linear. A 60-story building costs roughly 1.5 times per square meter compared to a 30-story building. A 120-story building costs roughly 3 times per square meter. The premiums come from everywhere. Longer construction timelines. 3 to 5 years for a super tall versus 1 to 2 for an ordinary skyscraper. Specialized labor, bespoke components, and that floor area ratio penalty we talked about. Above 200 meters, the cost per square meter rises faster than the rent premium in almost every market on Earth.
Which means megatalls are almost never economically rational.
They're vanity projects, national prestige statements, architectural diplomacy. The CTBUH's city rankings tell this story perfectly. Hong Kong has 553 skyscrapers, the most in the world. Shenzhen has 398. New York has 314. Those are the giants of total count. But the megatall list is almost entirely in Asia and the Middle East. Dubai has multiple megatalls despite having far fewer total skyscrapers than Hong Kong. Kuala Lumpur punches way above its weight.
Megatalls aren't about density. They're about signaling.
They're the architectural equivalent of a space program. Nobody builds a moon rocket because it's cost-effective. They build it because it says something about national capability and ambition. The Burj Khalifa put Dubai on the global architectural map in a way that 150-story buildings never could. It's a single structure that changed the city's brand. And that branding effect is real. Tourism to Dubai spiked after the Burj opened, and the building has appeared in countless films, advertisements, and magazine covers. It's arguably the most successful piece of architectural marketing in history.
That prestige comes with regulatory challenges that most building codes weren't written to handle.
This is a huge and under-discussed problem. Most building codes, the International Building Code, the Euro codes, have prescriptive provisions up to about 150 meters. Beyond that, you're in what's called performance-based design. There's no checklist. You have to prove to the authority having jurisdiction that your building will perform acceptably under fire, wind, seismic loads. But acceptably is a negotiation, not a standard.
Which means every megatall is, in some sense, an experiment.
Fire safety is where the gaps are scariest. Megatalls require refuge floors every 30 to 40 stories. Entire floors designed as fire-safe holding areas where occupants can wait if evacuation isn't possible. They need dedicated firefighter elevators with independent power and water supplies. Sprinkler systems need backup pumps capable of delivering over 1,000 PSI at the top of the building. That's serious hydraulic engineering. You're essentially building a municipal water system inside a single structure.
We've seen what happens when those systems aren't enough.
The Torch Tower fire in Dubai, 2023, that's a 337-meter residential supertall. The fire spread through aluminum composite cladding, which is exactly the same material that caused the Grenfell Tower disaster in London. It's a known problem. The panels have a polyethylene core that melts and burns, and the fire races up the facade faster than firefighters can ascend. The Torch Tower had a fire in 2015 too. Same building, same problem, 8 years apart.
Even at the supertall level, well below megatall, we've got unresolved safety issues with materials we know are dangerous.
The regulatory fragmentation makes it worse. Dubai's codes have been tightened since 2015, but enforcement is inconsistent. Some jurisdictions require fire-resistant cladding on tall buildings, some don't. There's no global standard for facade fire performance in supertalls, even though the physics of facade fires is well understood. It's a policy failure, not an engineering one. We know exactly how these panels behave in a fire. We've known since at least the early 2000s. The fix exists, non-combustible cladding materials like solid aluminum panels or terracotta, but they cost more, and in a competitive construction market, the cost differential is often enough to keep the dangerous stuff in play.
All right, let me try to pull this together into something a listener can actually use. You're standing in a city, looking at a skyline. How do you know what you're looking at?
Use the 300-meter test. Buildings below that threshold are, broadly speaking, commodity buildings. They're using established structural systems, standard elevators, conventional construction methods. They might be beautiful, they might be iconic, but they're not pushing any engineering frontiers. Buildings above 300 meters are qualitatively different. They have active systems, dampers, double-deck elevators, sky lobbies, aerodynamic shaping. They required performance-based design and specialized construction logistics.
Above 600 meters?
You're looking at a national statement. There are only 18 of them on the planet. Every single one required bespoke engineering solutions. They're not buildings in the ordinary sense. They're vertical research projects that happen to have tenants.
For anyone thinking about what to build, developers, planners, city officials, the data points to a pretty clear sweet spot.
40 to 60 stories, roughly 150 to 200 meters. That's where the cost per square meter is still reasonable, the elevator systems are standard, the wind engineering is manageable, and the leasable area ratio hasn't tanked yet. Above that, you're paying a premium that most rental markets won't support. The buildings that go higher are almost always either luxury residential, where the per square meter sale price justifies the cost, or state-backed projects where the economics are secondary.
The next time someone proposes a supertoll in a mid-tier real estate market, you can be pretty confident they're either bad at math, or they're spending someone else's money.
Or they're making a very long bet on prestige value, which, to be fair, sometimes pays off. The Burj Khalifa probably did pay off for Dubai, not in rental income, but in tourism, branding, and global visibility. It's just that the payoff is almost impossible to model in a spreadsheet. How do you quantify the economic value of becoming a city that people around the world can name and picture? There's no line item for that in a pro forma.
For the rest of us, skyscrapercenter.com is a rabbit hole worth falling into. The CTBUH data is freely accessible. Heights, completion dates, structural systems, city rankings. You can look up the tallest building in your city and see exactly where it sits relative to those 300-meter and 600-meter thresholds.
It changes how you see a skyline. You stop seeing tall buildings and start seeing engineering tiers. That one's a commodity high-rise. That one's got a tuned mass damper. That one required Kevlar elevator cables. Once you know the thresholds, you can't unsee them. Every building tells you what problems its engineers had to solve.
It's like learning to read a new language, except the language is steel and concrete, and the grammar is physics.
Which brings us to the open question. Will we ever see a mile-high building, 1,600 meters? The Jeddah Tower is aiming for 1,000, and that's already pushing the limits of current materials. Elevator rope weight, wind vortex shedding, thermal expansion, concrete pumping, construction logistics, every one of those problems gets harder faster than the building gets taller. Some engineers argue 1,000 meters is a hard ceiling without new materials. Carbon fiber structural elements, maybe. Active aerodynamic control surfaces rather than passive shaping.
A building with control surfaces. We're designing skyscrapers like aircraft now.
At a certain height, the distinction between a building and a vertical aircraft actually starts to blur. The wind loads are that dominant. And carbon fiber is promising, it's 5 times stronger than steel at a fraction of the weight, but it's also expensive, difficult to join to other materials, and behaves differently in a fire. You'd need a whole new set of building codes just to permit it as a primary structural material. So the mile-high building isn't just an engineering problem. It's a materials science problem, a regulatory problem, and an economic problem all wrapped together.
Yet cities in Southeast Asia and Africa are urbanizing fast, and the plans are already on the drawing board. Riyadh, Jakarta, both looking at clusters of multiple 600-meter-plus buildings. The engineering lessons from those 18 existing megatalls are going to define whether that's feasible or folly.
Whether the next generation of megatalls learns from the Torch Tower fires or repeats them.
Here's your homework. Go to Skyscraper Center, look up the tallest building in your city, check its height against the 300-meter and 600-meter thresholds. You'll never look at a skyline the same way again.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1931, a Portuguese colonial administrator on São Tomé and Príncipe discovered a set of wax cylinder recordings containing what turned out to be the only known audio of a Creole language called São Tomense Foro, as it was spoken before widespread Portuguese influence. The cylinders had been stored in a mislabeled crate in the governor's palace for over 2 decades and were nearly destroyed by tropical humidity. They survived because the wax had been inadvertently coated in a thin layer of palm oil that acted as a preservative.
Palm oil is an accidental archival medium. That's either genius or a very lucky mistake.
I'm going to go with both.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week with whatever Daniel throws at us.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.